This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 17th of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 306 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards.
On today's programme, we'll be meeting Syrian artist Sara Sharma, whose works have been influenced by the terrible ongoing conflict in her home country and look to offer new perspectives on the situation.
We'll also hear from Monocle's Budapest correspondent Adam Labor, who, when not making the headlines, is busy writing novels. He'll be here talking espionage at the UN a little later.
And we'll be heading to Australia and learning why 60,000 years of history in the region are getting a refreshing new spin at the British Museum with Tasmanian curator Gay Sculthorpe.
That's all coming up, plus Danny Jacopelli will be here with the news look ahead, and we'll have some great music too. That is all coming up on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Here we are, Tom. Here we are. It's Sunday. It's noon. It's episode 306 of the Monocle Weekly. And I hope our listeners will feel that they are in capable hands with us two on the rudder, on the tiller, steering the boat.
I'd hope so too. Sunday lunch now, Rob, for me means something very different. It used to mean, you know, maybe a roast chicken with all the trimmings.
Okay.
But now if someone says Sunday lunch to me, I just generally see your face.
And how do you feel about that? Do you feel, I mean,
is I've got to be honest, conflicted. No, I feel a sense of delight and wonder because I know that we go on these incredible journeys together where we meet all sorts of amazing people. We're going to be going, you know, north to south, east to west. Who will we find? We don't know.
Who knows? Just imagine. I'd say to you is when you offered up this nightmarish vision by your subconscious,
yes.
Just think of me with maybe a side of brand new, fresh in at the moment here in the UK, Jersey Royals, but butter and mint on top.
Butter and mint.
Maybe some broad beans on the side as well.
You've made my nightmare work for me.
Okay, yeah, it's all right, isn't it?
It's turned in from a waking nightmare into some sort of weird reverie.
Some weird
broad bean based reverie. Probably best to leave it there.
It probably is best to leave it there. I think we'll let the show speak for itself. We've got some fantastic guests coming up. We are not answerable though for the first feature because it is Daniel Jacopelli and his news look ahead.
Danny, there's no other but Danny.
Ah, very nice. Danny Jacopelli has commissioned his own theme music.
I have. I often do that. I'm getting used to this song, actually. I like it. I think it should follow me wherever I go.
Can I just say, I don't love you more, Danny, each day. My dislike grows a tad stronger.
But it's true. There's none other like me, though, so that part's true.
Mercifully, yes.
That's the way to introduce a regular guest.
Yes.
Danny, what's going to happen in the news?
Well, you know, I like to start with some parochial weeks and days here in the UK.
Yep.
It's British Tomato Week coming up.
Okay. They won't be ripe until August. Does anyone know this?
Is that true?
That's a general truth, I think. At least those a proper tomato grown out of doors.
Tomato, yes. It's the Tomato Growers Association's annual event.
Sorry, you said something I couldn't understand.
It's the Tomato Growers Association annual event.
Well done.
That's better.
Okay, fine. Beer as well. Pint of Science 2015.
Pint of Science?
It brings scientists and academics to local pubs around the world.
I love science. I love to have about 10 or 12 units of science a night.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Back in the day, this is where all the biggest discoveries were made, in pubs, in Oxford and Cambridge. And
yeah, exactly.
That's still true now.
The Eagle,
Double Helix,
Crick and Watson.
They ran
exactly.
in there.
Yeah.
They didn't actually discover it in there. They ran straight in there.
Well, they stole it from the those other people who invented it before them, didn't they? Controversially.
I think probably allegedly is what
allegedly is what, is what I want to say.
That's
it always seems the people who invented the things that we always think they invented, they never did. It was always a woman who did it 5 years before them that never got the credit.
Hello and welcome to Women's Hour with me, Danny Jacopelli.
No, but really, that's the case, right?
No, you're right. Do you know what? I think you're genuinely right.
Well, behind every great man is a great woman. That's what they say, isn't it?
I'll get a lot of angry letters from men in the next couple weeks.
And women. You've probably managed to upset everyone.
I'll get love letters from women, maybe, from that.
From what?
Baby,
from your
thing?
Your theme tune from your fan club that have written your theme tune, written, composed, and sung your theme tune.
That song's not actually about you, Danny. You do realise that.
So I have a really, really good one here.
This is changing the subject.
You know, a couple of weeks ago I had a Hedgehog Awareness Week.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
This is probably one-ups that. Dying Awareness Week.
Dying Awareness.
Dying.
Okay.
Death.
Like
is
dying.
All right, not just don't put a red t-shirt in with your white pants.
Okay. No, I probably should have double checked that. Tie-dye fun week.
Oh, Dying Awareness Week. Is it sponsored by, yeah.
It's the fifth annual Dying Matters Awareness Week.
Dying Matters?
The motto is Dying Matters, You Only Die Once. So the idea here
what
is
they,
to...
What are they trying to stop people from being squeamish about talking about it?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, it's to kind of make it a more palatable discussion.
Yeah.
I think that's, that's important, isn't it? To have an adult dialogue about these kind of things.
I suppose. In Paris on the 19th, the French Open. Do you guys like tennis?
I like what you don't like to dwell too much. How many topics have you got? Because you don't like to really dwell on any of them.
He rattles through them. It's almost like
he does. So that's all about dying, and that matters. And next, tennis.
I focus on the transitions. That's really what
I like
matters.
It. Okay, so the French Open, when's that
I
start?
I like Roland Garros. It's always good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is that a person or a place? I don't know.
Andy Murray Murray might win this year.
Might he? Has he got a favourable draw?
He's got a decent shout.
Okay, cool.
But he's not very good on clay, but he's...
Do you like Andy Murray?
Not really, but so I throw that in there.
I just don't like Scottish
people. National interest. Whoa. I like all British people equally.
Mm. The Man Booker International Prize in London on the 19th as well. Rob, that might
I get so confused
fancy.
With the different stages of the Booker. Is this the announcement of the long list, the announcement
it's presented
of the shortlist, or the actual whole award?
It's presented at the V&A.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who's going to win? Put on your news hat.
I don't even know. I know the British ones when they ever announce them, because they're kind of... The international ones, they're from all around the world, so you could have a writer that you might not have heard of in England or in New York. The UK ones are all pretty, you know who they are, because they always write in every paper every day, but...
That was the news with Martin Amis.
Also, a great event happening on the 20th. I used to go with my father and my grandfather all the time, annual Fleet Week. Fleet Week. So you have a Fleet Week here, I believe.
What's maybe. That? I don't know what that means.
I don't know what that is.
Oh, is it not? Okay. Well, it's a uniquely American thing. So a Fleet Week is when the Navy and the Marines, I suppose, arrive in New York, and all of the main tourist spots of New York are filled with essentially military people, and it's kind of a celebration of all things, military. It sounds a bit like militaristic, but it's not really. It's kind of just
a jingo. Is there nothing wrong with that?
A bit of jingoistic.
Is it right that your father and grandfather, that you're all called Daniel Giacopelli?
Yeah, that's correct. Well, Daniel, Danny, combination.
But it's coming from the root Daniel.
Yes.
So okay. Are you Daniel?
Which means
Giacopelli,
wisdom of God.
Daniel Giacopelli.
Are you Junior or Daniel Giacopelli the Third? Because you like to do that, Daniel, on your side of the Atlantic.
Daniel Giacopelli the Third.
Well, no, that's
you need to rebrand yourself. I would love that. I mean, Davis Love the Third.
That's
I love
only
this.
If you go to Phillips Andover and Yale, and I, went to better school. So, no, but you need to have a. You don't even know what that means. You're kind of,
I just want to know, are you going to have the little Roman numerals? Yeah.
No, you have to have the same middle name.
Oh. Okay.
Oh, so says the gods of names.
So you have to be Daniel, Frederick, Jacopelli, or whatever it might be.
Indeed.
Okay.
Probably not Frederick.
You don't have the same
name. No, but you know what I mean?
No, we all have different middle names.
Oh. Federico. What I like about that is if you're talking about sort of dynasties, it's Roman numerals, but if you're talking about knockabout comedies, then you use the number.
Yeah.
You use
like
numerals
too fast,
rather than
too
Roman
furious.
Numerals. Yeah, yeah. Fast and Furious 7.
9. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Fleet Week, I like that. So that's just basically an opportunity for you to go back home and get squashed up with a lot of sailors.
I feel like I should introduce some kind of serious things. Well, first, before serious,
we did talk about death already.
Yeah, I know. We went from death to tennis really quickly.
It's municipal elections in Spain in about a week's time on the 24th.
Municipal? What's that? What are you talking about? City mayors.
Yeah. So, we've been actually covering that all week on Monocle 24. And finally, I'm going to Geneva this week for the European Business Aviation Convention, and exhibition. Otherwise known as eBase.
You're spending a worryingly large amount of time in Switzerland at the moment, Danny. What are you up to?
I don't know. Have you recently got a pay rise?
Hiding away all my money, yeah.
Freebase. That's a great festival that would be.
Yeah, exactly.
Google it, kids. There's definitely
a Freebase festival.
Is there a Freebase festival? Probably not in Switzerland.
Probably not in Switzerland.
Zurich, probably. Not Geneva.
Denver.
Does that conclude the news look ahead?
That was the dramatic conclusion of the news look ahead.
Wow, I think it was pretty good though. We encompassed.
I think every week we get better and better.
Tomatoes, death, tennis,
sailors,
municipal elections,
sailors,
literature,
and freebasing. Danny Giacopelli, thank you for that smorgasbord of news delights.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
For London, this is Monocle 24.
世界の各地より。 Monocle 24 です。
Da Londra, questo è Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
From Midori House in London, you're tuned in to Monocle 24.
For London,
para Zurich,
a Barcelona,
to Tokyo,
aus Istanbul,
a Singapore.
Esta Monocle 24.
Da Mon Monocle 24.
Der loset Monocle 24.
Broadcasting around the world,
around the clock.
This is Monocle 24.
Sara Shammah is an artist from Syria whose exhibition, World Civil War Portraits, is currently on show at the Stolen Space Gallery in East London. Shammah's latest artworks interpret the bloody conflict going on in her home country, which she had to flee in 2012 after a car bomb exploded outside her home. Now Lebanon-based, she lives in exile with her young family, while her husband continues to work in Damascus.
Of course, hers is a uniquely personal perspective on a conflict that's claimed more than 200,000 lives. But Shammah's hope is that through her imagery, the globe might be further alerted to the fact that Syria's war is now truly a challenge for the world, not just the Syrians it affects most every day. Sara, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Great to have you with us. Before we talk about the specifics of your work, I guess a broad question. We constantly look to art to give us a way of understanding and making sense of the horrors and ravages of war. It's almost a bit of a cliche, but why for you does your art enable you to make sense? How does that process work?
I think art could reach anyone, or I prefer that my art could reach your subconscious through touching your feeling and your senses. So I lived this experience, this war experience. I think that lots of Syrian people, they're experiencing a very bad situation. So I think I might be luckier than others because I haven't experienced death or any other bad experience. But I experience the fear and the anxiety. So I think this all will reflect in my art in a way. And I want you to feel it. That's it.
We obviously read out an introduction to you, Sara, while you were sitting here in the room, which is a funny thing to do sometimes in front of people. Not a funny thing, but, you know, a strange, uncomfortable thing sometimes. But tell us your personal sort of experience of the war. We mentioned that your husband is still in Damascus. You're in Lebanon now with your children. But maybe talk us through that moment that made you have to leave.
Yeah. The war started in 2011. So we lived till the end of 2012. We lived there 1 year and a half or more. But at the end of 2012, this situation became really real and really dangerous. So I started to smell blood everywhere, even if there isn't any blood around me. And this anxiety, I started to, when I looked to my children's eyes, I started to cry, of course, not in front of them. Without any reason, so I couldn't handle it anymore. And some car bombs and some other bombs. So I think that life is too short to live this kind of experience. So I moved with my two young children. But still Damascus, I'm from Damascus, is maybe the most safest city in Syria, or one of the safest places. But it is a war. It is a war city. It's still a war in a war country. So there is lots of people who are still living there and who get used to it. And I think this is the people they need to live. So, but also there is a lots of people who couldn't handle it, so they moved. What else?
Well, I wonder about that sense of, you know, it's interesting, you look at the pictures, and I mean, Rob's described them already, there's a sense sometimes of these sort of fracturing, and you feel that through the pictures, you see it in the society, a society that's fracturing, whether it's people who have been forced to leave. Do you remain hopeful that you'll be able to return and return soon? I mean, the situation seems so entrenched now. Do you fear that this sort of instability, this disequilibrium is going to continue for the short term? Do you worry about, you know, what that means for your children and what their perception of what it is to be Syrian will be like as the years unfold?
People always move from place to another. So anyone who he need to get used to any other, to any new place. So I think I'm a positive to my life or to my children's life. Of course, I would love to come back to Syria, but I don't see in the near future anything positive in that respect. But Syria is my place, is a part of me. But at the end, you need to leave, you need to survive. This is another thing. You have to be strong enough. It's not only about Syrian. There is a lot of population during history who had to leave their country in for some reason, or especially because of the wars. So that's it.
You picked up on the fear and anxiety there, Sarah. And your portraits, as you said, the show's called Civil War Portraits. They are quite psychological pieces. I mean, there's photorealism. There's a bit of, in order to give people an idea, our listeners in their mind, there's a sort of an idea of Francis Bacon to some of these things. There's a lot of hanging meat, and it's human meat, it's flesh, you know. Mm. You're riffing on that. But they are quite psychological things. You're taking that thought of portraits onward, and I guess you're looking at the inside of people's heads rather than just their bloodied bodies as well.
Yes, exactly. The main interest for me is the people themselves, their eyes, how I look into their eyes so I can see through them. That's what I like to show in my art. And the flesh and the blood is part of us. It's not only about war. It's more a human thing, or it's more a lively thing, if we can describe it like that.
A lot of people have said that there has been such an amount of bloodshed in the Middle East that there is not enough good imagery to back up the news stories in a very mercenary way. You know what I mean? Some of these stories have stopped being reported because there is simply not enough good footage and good photography to come out of there. Mm. Do you have a point of view on that? I mean, obviously, you've taken, as we said, your art takes a psychological, a portrait way of looking at this, and obviously you're working in oil on canvas, not with a camera. But I wonder if you have a comment on the imagery that's come out of the Syrian war.
Yes, because art could give you a very specific point of view, or a very personal. You can see the situation and the conflict in a very personal way. I think it is different than see it through the journalist photos and through the news. You can feel it more through artists.
Yeah, and also you get used to news footage. You get used to seeing stretches being pulled out of burning buildings and all the rest of it. Whereas this is taking it in a very different direction.
Yes, because it is not personal.
Yeah.
When you see news, the same images, you start not feel anything about it. So I think when a writer describes his feeling toward the war, or an artist or a singer, so it will reach you in the depth.
I wonder also whether there's an issue that we mentioned the numbers, staggering numbers now, hundreds of thousands of people who've died and been terribly injured. Is there a point also where the sheer scale of the suffering, the sheer scale of the numbers becomes so great that it's hard to really understand anymore, and you need something that is visceral, like, you know, a depiction of somebody's eyes like we see in your work, that focus, as you said, on the personal, on the individual, to reconnect the world who you're watching with what these... Because, stories of suffering really mean, because we see 10,000, 50,000, 100,000. Exactly. It almost stops having meaning because the scale is so frightening.
You reach a point when you can't feel the human himself because it is over 100,000. So you start to forget that this is a human's.
And looking through the catalogue of your exhibition, Sarah, I'm struck by the, as we said, there's sort of photorealism in some of these pictures. And there's amazing faces and eyes and expressions. And there's also self-portraits in there, which are very striking. Mm. Are you painting from memory? Are these fictitious people? Are these photographs that you took? Are these family members? Who are the people in the pictures?
In this show, there is this self-portrait that you describe it. And there is another painting called The Butcher. She's a very tiny lady, very nice one. She's a butcher. So I get to know her in Lebanon. I went to visit her and to take some photos and to see how she slaughtered the animal. But the funny thing that she's been doing this job over 35 years, maybe, But every time she wants to slaughter an animal, she gets dizzy and gets sick, and maybe she will fall down on the floor.
Okay. So she's a butcher with smelling salts in her apron, right?
But after the animal will die, she will continue working as usually. So I get inspired a lot by this lady. There is another one also in Lebanon. She's a maid. Maid of my aunt in Lebanon. So she's very inspiring for me. Her eyes are loving and very understandable. And so I make some drawing for her. Then I make this portrait of her. But the funny things, again, that all of the people who came to my studio to visit me, they get shocked by this woman because they think that they knew her. But nobody recognized her. They all related her to my aunt and my husband's aunt. But they didn't recognize her because she's a maid and usually they don't recognize her.
Yeah.
This is one of the paintings.
And in terms of this collection, this body of work, is that you... Have you... I mean, I'd hope that this painting, these pieces, is cathartic in some way for you and you're telling the story of your war and of the people that don't have their voice to try and tell their story as well. Is that the Syrian war done for you as an artist? Have you got that out of your system, do you feel? Or do you feel it's still burning in you every day to want to make art about it?
Everything makes me make art. And this issue, I think, is tiring. The Syrian issue, it's very tiring, it's burning me as you describe it. But I think now it's not only about Syria, it's about the whole world, because this war started from Syria, now it's spreading all over the world, maybe, especially the Arab country, Copenhagen, Paris, never know. So I think this war should stop, because it might reach you or reach any other countries. So it's a civil war, because the fighters are fighting their own countrymen in any place.
Do you consider the work then, your work, to be political in that sense? Does it have a message? Is it about trying to galvanize people to maybe make, you know, the Western world in particular more involved, to ask what they can do to affect things in a more immediate way? Or are they not political works? Are they documents of your experience, of your feelings, the sort of artistic instincts you've been describing?
I don't think I'm a political artist. And to tell you the truth, I don't think that political art could change anything. Maybe we'll do some propaganda about something else, but I don't think it will change. So I am a humanitarian artist.
Sara Shammah, thank you so much for coming in. The pictures, they're confrontational, but they're beautiful as well. They're called World Civil War Portraits. They're on at the Stolen Space Gallery in London until the 24th of May. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Time for some new music now. We'll be talking about Australia's Indigenous history later on in the show, but let's hear now from some of the country's current musical favourites from Melbourne. This is Twerps with I Don't Mind.
That was Twerps out of Melbourne with I Don't Mind. And we're going to be talking about espionage at the United Nations and other intrigues with Adam Labor right after this.
Monocle's unrivaled network of editors and correspondents around the world bring you a brilliant new collection of books, the Monocle Travel Guides. Speaking in an informed but informal way about everything from architecture to art, late night bars to early morning markets, the Monocle Travel Guides mix the classic with the contemporary, going beyond the conventional and revealing the hidden spots that cities have to offer. Published by Gestalten, these travel guides are for people who want to get the most out of their stay, however short, and feel like locals rather than tourists in the world's great cities. These series kicks off with London and New York, available now in Monocle shops, at monocle.com, and in all good bookstores. And watch out for Hong Kong and Tokyo on the way soon. The Monocle Travel Guides. Cities are fun. Let's explore. Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
As Monocle's Budapest correspondent, Adam Labor is no stranger to keeping his eye on the corridors of power. The journalist has authored successful factual exposés, focusing on areas ranging from Muslim minorities in Europe and the US to the international banking system.
But he's also a novelist. Labor has been creating a spy series over recent years, following the antics of Yael Azoulay, a former Mossad agent and covert United Nations negotiator. And his latest book, The Washington Stratagem, sees Azoulay combating a plot to create a new war in the Middle East. Adam, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Great to have you with us. Maybe I'll start by asking you about the genre, the sort of political thriller. Why do you think it remains such a sort of compelling genre of fiction? What draws you to it?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, a lot of people thought that in 1989, once the Cold War supposedly ended, that would be the end. There was all these gloomy articles, no more communism, no more need for spy thrillers. But the world, as we've seen, has become much more complex and much more difficult. And I think there's even more of an appetite for good espionage thrillers. And we're seeing a number of new authors come through. So for me as a writer, it's really the most challenging thing to write fiction. First, there's journalism, and then there's non-fiction books. But to do fiction demands a whole new area of expertise and commitment and just an enormous amount of self-belief.
That's a trick, I suppose. But when you are staying up all night and you're enduring all these hours of teeth-grinding lunacy writing these books, Adam, I wonder whether you think actually the best way to make people understand the issues at stake here, whether it is the banking stuff, which comes into this book as well, certainly the Middle Eastern situation, all these things, whether these difficult issues are best dealt with in fiction rather than actually in a news broadcast or in non-fiction?
I think there's room for both. Obviously, journalism and non-fiction is one way of approaching it, but there's going to be people that aren't going to pick up a long article or a big book about the topic, but might well read a thriller about it. And there is quite a long tradition of thriller writers dealing with more complex political and geopolitical issues. I mean, it goes right back to the 1930s. If you look at Eric Ambler's work, often they had a protagonist who was a kind of everyman figure that was thrown into some incredible conspiracy, who had to kind of fight his way out and survive. And it was really very much about what was happening in the 1930s in Europe at the time, with these dark forces massing and these long shadows being thrown by fascism and Nazism. And I think people could read those kind of books then and understand something of what was happening in the world, whereas they probably wouldn't have read a long, drier book about what was going on in Italy or Nazi Germany.
And does it give you, I mean, as a novelist, you've got quite a lot of responsibility to be teetering on the edge of actual fact without ever delving into it. And I mean, that's the thing, right? When you're so close to the edge as you are with this series of the Yael Azoulay books, you've got a bit of responsibility.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Especially as she works for the UN, you do feel a sense of responsibility that you're dealing with touchy things like a potential new war in the Middle East, that you have to deal with it intelligently, but at the same time trying to illustrate some of the darker currents in geopolitics that people aren't aware of. So obviously my work draws on my work as a journalist as well.
They're heavily researched, a lot of depth. I just wondered, did you ever get any sort of blowback from people who say, well, you know what, Adam, you wrote that, you know, she did X, Y, and Z here. That's not the way that would have happened. Does that happen? Do people sort of delight in attempting to put the record straight? And do you have to sort of duke it out and say, well, no, look, my research tells me something different?
Not exactly. What's happened more is that I found people who work for the United Nations say, although it's obviously a fictional series and she doesn't exist, you kind of got something of the atmosphere of how we work and the kind of superpower intrigue behind the scenes. Yeah, it's like that. And they're quite intrigued by that. And I have...
And no one said, is it based on? And then named names or anything like that?
No, because it's what she does, the job doesn't exist. As far as I know, unless it's on a very, very deep, deep, mega covert level. But I've had, and since then, people in the UN have said, you know, why don't you have a think about this so I can tell you about that? And, you know,
yeah, that's what you want. How do you do the research for these books?
Well, I did a non-fiction book about the United Nations called Complicity with Evil, about its failures in Rwanda and Bosnia and Darfur. And that's when I really began to unpeel the organisation. And a lot of people spoke to me, because people will talk at the UN as long as you don't want to use their name.
Right.
You know, as long as it's off the record or on deep background, they'll talk quite freely. But if you want to quote them, they won't say anything apart from...
Well, that's when fiction works very well, doesn't it? Because
yeah, exactly.
You don't have to. The sources are always...
And also, you know, what I'm trying to do here is also tell a story, you know, with a good character-based story about a woman dealing with the complexities of her life and her haunting backstory and the things she's done that are sort of dark ghosts around her, and also the complexes that, you know, the complex issues that she has to face herself as a woman in her 30s. So it's character-driven also.
I wanted to ask you a bit about the sort of, I guess it's a broader question about the creative process. You mentioned obviously the non-fiction work, your journalistic work and so on. Do you find things that you realise will be good to be woven into a piece of fiction? Or does it work the other way around, that you have a story, you have this character, as you just described, with these, you know, their own background, and then you draw on things from your past experience or things that you read about to weave in? Which way round does it happen, or is it a bit
of a mix? It's a bit of a mix, but I think it's more, I read the papers every day and I think, oh, that's really interesting. Sometimes it's like little stories you see about something, like, you know, about conflict diamonds being smuggled somewhere or something like that, just a little story, and you think, you know, that could be much more interesting, and you start digging into it. But I think the trick is not to become too hung up on your research, because sometimes... I hope I don't make that mistake, but some novelists, you know, they go into long, long descriptions. Especially, there's a certain breed of American action thriller novelists, and they have so much stuff about munitions and penetration rates and calibers and accuracies and refiring. And you think, oh, God, you know, it's like
brackets. Imagine the depth of my research here.
Yeah, exactly. You think this must be written for the National Rifle Association members or something.
Yeah, but that's an internet search history that does not want to be opened.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And tell us, I mean, we've mentioned your protagonist, your heroine, Yael Azouli. Why a woman, and how easy did you find it to put yourself in the body of a 30-year-old woman? I'll rephrase that.
I think mind is the phrase, is the noun we're looking for here.
Yeah.
Well, it was a big challenge, you know, because I think many men are puzzled already quite how women think, because we know that men and women think differently. So it was a big challenge. So the challenge of it was very appealing, to have a female protagonist. And it was just a challenge, really.
And again, it's quite different, isn't it? I mean, we have so many kind of like buff guys. I mean, you know, kind of running around and doing things and being action men and all the rest of it. And maybe being complicated heroes and anti-heroes in one character. But this is it's a nice, refreshing departure.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, with a woman, you've got always the tension between the action scenes, you know, if she's going up against a bad guy, there are some fight scenes. It's not such a clear-cut thing if you've got your hero's already like a, you know, a really massive guy and he's SAS commando or something like that. You know he's going to win. But if it's a woman, that's, you know, there's much more tension there.
And and it's one of those things we talked about the novels of the 1930s that sort of started this genre. And we feel that most people that have waged wars have certainly read Evelyn Waugh's Scoop and based their antics on that book itself. How closely can you read around the subject? I mean, can you derive pleasure from thrillers, or do you have to kind of completely wean yourself off anything that's similar to this, lest it contaminate your own writing?
No, I read a lot of thrillers, vast amount. Just a vast amount. Although
to get into the vibes.
Yeah, exactly. What happens after a while, though, now that I've written four, actually, because I've just finished the sequel to The Washington Stratagem, is you do start to see the engineering, how it works. So that takes away the pleasure a bit, because on one level it's interesting because you think, oh, he did that. That's quite interesting to do that flashback there, not worried about narrative drive or whatever, blah, blah, blah. But I still read an awful lot of them. I should read some other things. I plan to spend the summer reading Dickens.
That's good. Is that going to be, can we ask, is that going to be an influence in the next instalment that you finish writing?
I hope so. Yeah, I hope so. All writers should be influenced by who they've read, especially if it's someone like Dickens.
Yeah, because he was quite good, as I've heard. I mean.
Yeah, not bad. Yeah, could keep a story going for several hundred pages, which is what it's all about, really.
That's what we want. We want Nicholas Nickleby investigating the industrial military complex. heard it here first.
Oliver Twist on the food. Yeah, on the global food industry.
Please, sir, can I have a bit less, sir?
Yeah.
Well, Adam, congratulations on
the
book. It
is
The Washington Stratagem. It's out now. The author is Adam Labore. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
They have reported, listened, watched, quizzed, and cajoled. They've been to farms and galleries, conclaves and bars. They've reported from the high north and tropical metropolises. And you? Well, all you need to do is turn the dial, click our app, or pop in your headphones and head off on an audio tour of the spikiest, juiciest, funniest moments from Monocle 24's week that was. The Curator is our one-hour show that informs, entertains and surprises with the best bits from all of our magazine shows. From The Urbanist to The Menu, The Stack to The Entrepreneurs, The Culture Show to Section D. Premiering live every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time, you can also subscribe to the programme at monocle.com or on iTunes or SoundCloud to ensure you never miss a beat. Come on, let's catch up this weekend. Listen to The Curator.
The Big Interview is Monocle 24's bold new series featuring in-depth interviews with inspirational names in global politics, business, culture, and design.
For me, the worst thing is the client says, oh, well, do whatever. I think, what the hell? Then I'd be an artist. Then why should you pay me to do whatever? There is a job here to do.
Hosted by our senior editors, it brings you unique, illuminating one-on-one discussions with fascinating characters as we find out what makes them tick.
In those moments when I am looking death in the eye, I ask myself repeatedly, why can I not turn away from the story? And I just kept going back to Iraq, to Afghanistan, at the expense of my life.
With insights into some of the sharpest minds shaping their fields today, it's a show you wouldn't want to miss. So tune in every Sunday at 9 a.m. London time for The Big Interview, right here on Monocle 24.
The British Museum is currently taking a conclusive look back, 60,000 years or so in fact, at the history of Australia and the inhabitants who shaped the land for the huge majority of that time, Indigenous peoples. The period previous to the westernisation of Australia was just as rich, complex and varied as the land we see today, with skilled crafts, trade links to Indonesia and hundreds of different Indigenous groups. The exhibition and accompanying book, Indigenous Australia Enduring Civilization, aims to redress perceptions about this period through its objects.
On show are items ranging from traditional artefacts found by members of Captain Cook's landing party in 1770 to more contemporary art from painters such as Simon Hogan, Michael Cook and Wuta Wuta Changala. Joining us now to tell us more is curator of the event and section head of the Oceania Department at the British Museum, Gay Sculthorpe. Gay, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. It's great to have you with us in the studio. Rob mentioned there 60,000 years of extraordinary heritage. I guess it prompts the question, why decide to sort of take the plunge now and look at this in this way at the British Museum at this precise moment?
Well, firstly, it's been a very long time since the British Museum has done an exhibition on Indigenous Australia. The last one was, in fact, in the 1980s at the Museum of Mankind, and that dealt with Australian Aboriginal people and not with Torres Strait Islander people as well. So this exhibition deals with both Aboriginal peoples and Torres Strait Islander peoples. Although it's been a long time, there's been a lot of knowledge that's been gained over the last 30 or 40 years through a project with our colleagues at the Australian National University and the National Museum of Australia. We've been researching our collections, and the significance of the objects has become more and more clear. So it seemed like a great time at the end of the project to actually have an exhibition here in London. And with the objects that you see here on exhibition, many of those, in fact, will then travel back to Australia in November for a related exhibition at the National Museum of Australia. So that will be a significant moment also when those objects go back, many for the first time since they were collected.
And do you think the gaze has changed on what we might call Indigenous Australian art, or you know, pre-Western Australian art within the last 10 years or so? There's a great, amazing, healthy market for this stuff. Does that change the way that people in London, for example, as we're talking about the British Museum, look at the art of the last 60,000 years?
Well, I hope this exhibition will change people's gaze.
Yeah.
People here seem to be familiar with what often people refer to as dot paintings, which are paintings that do often come from the arid centre of Australia. So what people will see in this exhibition is a really broad range of objects and artworks, because as you mentioned earlier, there are hundreds of different Aboriginal groups and Torres Strait Islander groups. Each has its own history, traditions, culture, and the form of art varies enormously. So what people will see in this exhibition are bark paintings, photographs, works on canvas, a great range of diverse material. So I think by showing the diversity and the depth of these artworks and cultural objects, I really hope it will change the gaze.
And I just wanted to pick up on a sort of point Rob alluded to there about the idea of, you know, the London location of this exhibition before it goes back to Australia. Will that speak, do you think, to the relationship of, you know, the colonial world? Was that an important factor in terms of the perception of art, whether people felt that the art, as you mentioned, some of it will be returning for the first time since it was found, in inverted commas? Is it complicated? Are we in a sort of post-colonial period in terms of how people engage with this sort of work?
Well, I think it's quite a complicated relationship between Australia and Britain, and Indigenous people and Britain and the Crown. And it's quite symbolic and important that this exhibition is being held in London, which was once the heart of the British Empire that ruled so much of Aboriginal Australia for so many years. Throughout Australian history in the last 250 or so years, there's been a continual engagement between Indigenous peoples and Britain. And often gifts were sent to the Crown, brought back here. In the exhibition, people can see objects like a emu feather apron from 1840s in the state of Victoria. And objects like that were sent as diplomatic gifts to the wedding of the Princess of Wales in about 1863. And so this exhibition and the Indigenous people who have contributed to its development here, it's that ongoing engagement. So I think it's a complex engagement that is part of a continuum.
You mentioned, I mean, that sounds like a great thing, the emu feather apron. And it reminds me of the stuff I've seen at the Alexander McQueen show at the V&A at the moment, actually. And this is something that I've seen with Aboriginal art, having seen it in so many private collections and in museum shows as well, is that wonderful blurred line between the absolutely contemporary and the ancient that you see. It seems, especially in Aboriginal art, shapes that seem straight out of modernism, canvases that could be a Sean Scully canvas, and then you look at the date and you realise it's from, you know, the 17th century or something. This stuff is amazing. It must be nice as a curator to play with people's perceptions like that.
Yes, and I think if you look carefully in the way the exhibition is presented, we have thought quite carefully about the notion of time within the exhibition. Yeah. So in the first part of the exhibition that deals with notions of understanding country, there are objects in there that were very old and also objects that are very contemporary. So the themes and the stories and the traditions are ongoing.
So it's nice to do it thematically so that you're not just doing a chronograph of this was then and this is now.
No, because we're dealing with a culture and peoples with living traditions. And therefore, that's one of the, you know, very interesting and also challenging things in putting an exhibition like this together. There are people here who can speak for these objects. For every object, there's a group or a person who's got something to say.
Can I ask a little bit about the public perception and how, to pick up, Rob was talking about your role as a curator and how sort of stimulating it must be working with these different, such a wide breadth of material. How about how you're talking to the audience? Are you aware that when, you know, the London audience at the British Museum, as against the audience at the Museum of Australia, for example, that you need to tell a different story or highlight a different aspect of this? Or do you think there's a, I don't know, sort of a universality that speaks to people, whether they're in London or whether they're, you know, 10,000 miles away?
No, it's a completely different audience. Before we finalised the text and the objects for the exhibition, we did audience research here. And that showed that people here were very interested in the subject, but didn't have a lot of information. So therefore, the first part of the exhibition does give basic information, including an incredibly large map of Australia showing all the different language groups across Australia, and basic information about connection to country, notions of the dreaming, size and scale, that when the objects go to Australia for the related exhibition, they'll be having a different narrative. So, yes, the audience research clearly showed there was an interest, but the level of background knowledge was different and our exhibition has been tailored accordingly.
And, you know, you said you've done audience research before, you've written your curatorial notes, your wall text, all the things that people might need to, you know, as props to walk around a show and feel like they're knowing what's going on and they're getting it. What have you tackled the idea of, you know, we've talked about collecting. What about the idea of plundering some of this stuff? And as you said in your first answer, you know, some of these works are going to be going back to Australia for the first time since they were collected, in inverted commas, the size of this building. So do you tackle that issue in this show?
Yes, very deliberately. Yeah. it's a subject that we think can't be avoided.
No.
Some objects are very new, some are very old. People have different views about where objects should be. And both in the exhibition and the accompanying book, we look at how some of these objects were acquired. And there were very many different ways. We also indicate in the text that there are different views about this as well. And I'm sure that this is a debate that will continue when the objects do go back to Australia.
So you're not sticking the emu feathers back on the emu just yet?
It strikes me, I mean, is there a sort of a lobbying group? I mean, talking about the British Museum, you think of something like the, you know, Elgin Marbles, I mean, you obviously read constantly about these battles and these counterclaims. Is there a lobby within Australia that's very committed to having a lot of these artefacts, especially the very ancient stuff, you know, that say, look, this should be in Australia. It should be part of our cultural heritage in a more immediate way. It's fine that it's on display in London or wherever it might be from private collections, but actually it should be back in Australia. Is there quite a strong sort of lobbying group voicing that opinion?
Oh, yeah, there are some voices that, you know, who say these objects should be back in Australia. And I think I can understand that people whose objects were in some cases deliberately taken away many years ago, people might have that feeling. But there's a range of views about that, and I think the important thing is to engage in dialogue and conversation about these issues. So it is an important conversation.
Just finally, when you yourself walk around that show, you put it together, you now stand back and maybe you're interested in hearing what people say to each other as they walk around it. Maybe you can be a bit of a fly on the wall there, but your work is sort of done. When you look around it, do you think, wow, 60,000 years, it's quite an amazing, it's a weighty responsibility for a curator, but it must be an amazing thing to sit back and feel that you have had 60,000 years of art to play with in those rooms.
I think that isn't the biggest challenge. I think the biggest challenge is putting an exhibition together that does justice to all the different Indigenous groups in Australia whose objects are represented in this exhibition, and to put an exhibition on in London about people's culture in a way that does justice to the complexity of this story,
yeah,
is really quite a challenge. One of the things, though, I've been struck with is now that the exhibition is open and people are walking around, people are really intently reading the labels. And I've often thought that while I can understand that when James Cook landed on the shores of Botany Bay in 1770, or the first fleet arrived in 1788, and the British colonists at that time were struck by the fact they assumed there was only one language, Aboriginal language. They had no idea that there were hundreds of languages. But I can accept that, but I do find it's interesting now that visitors to the exhibition who aren't from Australia see the map of Australia with all the different groups and different languages, and it's almost just as much a revelation now to the British here as it was perhaps to Cook or the First Fleet in 1788.
Nice one. Well, it's an amazing thing, and ambitious is hardly the word. The show is called Indigenous Australia, Enduring Civilization, and is on at the British Museum now. Gay Skelthorpe, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And there we have it, Tom. That was edition 306 of the Monocle Weekly.
I'd probably put that in the top, certainly the top 100.
How many? Well, okay. You would put it in the top 102 and a half?
Yeah.
It's to make it in the top third?
It's in the top third.
Okay. I like Gay Skelthorpe. She was good, wasn't she?
Really interesting. And I'd sort of encourage people to go along and check out some of that. I think what you said really struck me, which is this idea of things that look incredibly contemporary, and then you read the little description, and it's like, oh, actually, this is from 4,000 years ago. It's just amazing.
Absolutely bananas. It's one of the British Museum did this really well with Grayson Perry's show, The Tomb of the Unknown Craftsman. I don't know if you saw that show, where he took artifacts from, you know, ancient Greece and all over the place and sort of Mesopotamia, and then did his own artwork sort of next to them, or put them next to little bits by Henry Moore or things that have riffed on those modernist works that have riffed on the ancient. And that was a lovely thing, and I think they've done it again with this. This is a little bit more natural and social. This is a bit more social history. It has to tread a little bit more lightly rather than having that lightness of touch that Grayson Perry has. But nonetheless, it's a fabulous thing, right?
Very much so.
Nice one. Should we thank our team behind the glass?
I think we should do it.
Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. And the Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. But for now, from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.